Hi, welcome to Convince Me, a podcast brought to you by the Front Row Network in NPR, Illinois. I'm your host, Larry Smith. I also happen to be a stand-up comic, and for as long as I can remember, I've been fascinated with what people love, what they don't love, what makes them laugh, and what they don't laugh at. And on this show, we're going to explore a little bit of all that. So, thanks for joining us, and here's Convince Me. Today, I have a buddy of mine with me. We met once long ago. It was a special night. A beautiful evening.
A special night.
There's not a lot of people that you can eat barbecue chicken with in a hot tub and still look each other in the eye the next day. And I feel like we have. I've got the lead singer, songwriter, and bassist for an awesome band. It's one of my, honestly, legit, one of my favorite bands, the Royal Hounds. Scott Hines is with us.
Hello. Hello. Hi, hi friends.
Hello, new friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we...
You know that night that you mentioned, we were just invited over to a friend's house, and I think the strangest part was chasing dogs. Their dogs escaped, and I was in my underwear chasing dogs in a busy street while it's like 25 degrees out.
Yes.
And mainly because they were having a hot tub. I didn't bring a bathing suit, so I was like, well, I'll just wear my boxers. And I accidentally let the dogs out of the fence, and we're all running around downtown Champaign, Urbana, or whichever end of the city where we were in, and in our underwear, 25 degrees, trying to chase these dogs at you know, in the middle of the night.
Yeah, and I think the worst part, like, you in your underwear was fine. The fact that I was wearing Kayla's robe to try to be decent was worse. I had one flip-flop chasing dogs. We had a few margaritas that evening.
Yeah.
And the bus, my favorite part is the bus just kept going. I don't even know if that was their route, but they just kept going around. Just what the hell is this?
What is happening?
I'm going to call the pound and the cops. What is...
Yeah, that was a wild, wild, crazy night.
There's a bald gorilla in a woman's house coat. Stop it.
Yeah, that was an evening for the ages, I guess.
It was a beautiful night, and that's how friends are made, Scott. I think we can attest that's how friends are made. Because time that night got over with, we were like, "This is it. We are friends, and we're good with each other." So, because in that situation, when again, if you're eating barbecue chicken in your underwear in a hot tub. You can look each other in the eye.
That's true.
And that's not the only time I've been in that situation in their hot tub.
Oh, wow. You've chased dogs in the street in a bathrobe, in Kayla's bathrobe, before.
It was after that, yeah. But still, it was same situation. And I was like, how does this keep happening? And then I asked them if they had hidden cameras, if they were going to put it on YouTube.
Or an NPR.
Yes. Well, that's okay. On my show, they put the little E next to it just to give everyone a warning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They're like, yeah, we're going to bring on a comedian. Let's make sure everyone knows that he's awful. Don't listen to this with the kids. So something I was going to bring up first, because I think it's super cool. You guys got mentioned by Rolling Stone recently, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. We we were one of the very first to jump onto the I wouldn't even say jump onto the live streaming of concert bandwagon, because there wasn't a bandwagon. It was almost like before the states even started shutting down, I kind of looked around and I was like, oh, we're going to need a game plan. And so I kind of reached out to a local venue here in Nashville called Roberts and kind of pitched them this idea. And they kind of worked on it. And we got in at that ground level. And that's when Rolling Stone put out the article about, hey, bands are doing live streams now. That's a thing, and mentioned us along with Roberts and a couple other bands that play at Roberts. So I was like, wow, Rolling Stone. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's, I mean, anybody who performs wants to be mentioned by Rolling Stone. And the fact that I was just telling people, I know a guy who's in a band that was, I felt cool just being.
Oddly enough, that was, and I'm not saying this to brag, but I'm saying this just because it floors me, because I'm like, who the heck am I? You know, it's the second time I was in Rolling Stone. One time I was recording at a recording studio. Just a buddy just happened to need some upright bass, so I was like, I'll show up, whatever. And they snapped my picture, and like it was a few weeks later, Rolling Stone did an article on the top five studios in Nashville. And they just happened to use my picture randomly. And so had nothing to do with anything I've done that's important at all. It was just random. So, yeah, so it's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. I thought you had been at least in Rolling Stone once before. And I tried to look it up, and I couldn't find it. So I was like, I know this one for sure, and I don't want to put my foot in my mouth. So I'm glad that you brought it up.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of neat.
Do me a favor. I could explain the Royal Hounds all day long, but that's like asking somebody else to explain my comedy. I'm sitting right there? Tell everybody what. I mean, not tell us what you're all about, but you know, describe your music. Tell people what it is, because I love it.
Yeah. So the Royal Hounds, you know, we are a lighthearted, high energy band that is not out there to make serious introspective statements. I mean, we have songs about I have a song about bacon, you know, even though everyone talks about bacon and stuff. I have another song about a wife who is ticked off at her husband because he keeps blowing all the rent on beer and won't do any of the dishes, you know, or a song dedicated to people who can't dance. You know, it's just that sort of stuff. But, you know, we make sure that like the musicianship is stellar because, you know, we don't, it's a real fine line. It's like in stand up or not stand up. It's like in comedy, you know, the whole, Chaplin said, if the situation is funny, the, character doesn't need to be funny. Just needs to be like, just solid straight man. Mm-hmm. But if there's nothing inherently funny about the situation, like a job interview, then the characters can be funny. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like with the role, it's like the comedic rule of negation, you know, those two comic elements will cancel each other out. It'll just be unfunny. So with the Royal Hounds, it's a similar thing. We do really lighthearted, fun, silly stuff, sing songs about silly topics, but the musicianship is just like has to be solid. We have just like one of the best guitarists around. I mean, if I do say so myself, he's just amazing. And I just think that the silly songs couldn't stand on their own if you didn't have really solid musicians backing it up, you know? And So I take the music really seriously. But the performance is just a lot of fun.
The performance is great because I've watched a lot of the live performances and the videos, and watching you guys perform is just a blast. Well, you got the guitarist jumping up on the bass while you're holding it and playing it, or you guys are switching up. It's just
like playing each other's instruments at the same time, sort of stuff, you know, and it all comes down to, you know, just wanting to entertain an audience. And when you have so many introspective singer songwriters, you know, you can only do that so much. The world also needs just, you know, people who are just going to put on a fun show.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me mute my phone.
You're very important. I understand. I get it because, like, you know, I've always said with comedy, I take writing seriously. I take performing seriously. Mm-hmm. I take the product, not to use that term, but I take the product seriously. I do not take myself seriously at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Kyle Kinane that said, if you ever find a comedian with an ego, kick him to the curb. That's not,
You know,
and that's with most artists. If you've got an ego, I get it that you need introspective people. We need Marc Maron. I mean, mm-hmm. we need comedians like Marc Maron. We need songwriters like Jason Isbell.
Mm-hmm.
Introspective and
yeah,
and, but
you and know, I freaking love Jason Isbell.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah,
the world needs that.
Yes.
You know.
Yo, I love, yeah, that, just, the new album is great, if you haven't heard it, but.
I have, actually.
Yeah, it's so good. The article that I, anyway, we could do a whole episode about Jason Isbell,
yeah, yeah.
Maybe one day I will, or I'll just have him on, just for, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm with NPR. I can get anybody.
That's right.
I'm Larry Smith. I can...
Wait, a comedian with an ego.
Oh!
To the curb,
in
man.
The show! Stop recording. But yeah, it's you need the... You take the other part of it seriously, but you guys just don't take yourselves seriously. You can...
Yeah.
You're fun and silly, but the vocals are great. The songwriting is solid. And the, like, how would you describe your style of music? Cause,
it's a lot, based in roots music. You know, the band started off as a rockabilly band, you know, and even though, I mean, yes, it's a three piece with an upright bass now. So no matter what we play, we could do Gregorian chants and people are going to go, oh, rockabilly, you know,
uh-huh.
But by this point, it's veered a little more towards honky tonk and kind of surf and swamp, like swamp rock sort of stuff, you know, but with that lighthearted aspect to it. And now, you know, we play very, very little rockabilly at the show, but people will still call us rockabilly because I play upright bass, you know,
sure.
But
and you wear Western style shirts.
And I wear Western style shirts, but I've always loved that style,
yeah.
You know, regardless, but yeah, it's like, And for a long time, I was like, oh, we're not rockabilly. But now I'm just kind of getting to the point where I'm just like, you know, if people show up to our shows, whatever, you know, I just want to keep doing this, you
they
know.
As long as they're buying tickets and having yep. a good time, call me whatever you want.
Yeah, and it's funny because the rockabilly people are like, you're not rockabilly. And I'm like, oh, okay,
yeah,
whatever.
you're right, but okay, thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
So now I'm going to bring this up. You were in Million Dollar Quartet.
Yeah.
Out in Vegas.
Oddly enough, playing the father of rockabilly.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So you, because you were a middle school teacher, right?
Mm-hmm.
Middle school.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. you just went, I'm going to go and audition. Isn't that, am I getting the story right?
Yeah, that's what it was. It was, goodness. I was, somebody had told me, another musician out of Seattle had told me, Scott, you should be in musical theater. And I was like, musical theater, blah, you know. And so he's like, no, there's this show, Million Dollar Quartet, about like the birth of rock and roll that I think you'd be good at. So I looked up and found out there was going to be an audition in New York City in June, and school year had just finished the week before. I had 3 days where I sandwiched together where I didn't have any gigs, and I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna go up to New York, I'll audition and I won't get the part. Because who am I? I'm a middle school teacher from Tennessee, you know, and so I go up there and then I eventually got the part. And I guess the fact that I was a musician from Tennessee made me perfect to play the role of a musician from Tennessee, Carl Perkins, you yeah. know. So it's just it was I did it for about 3 years and it was a wild ride. I got to see and do things I never would have dreamed, and I'm so grateful for it.
It's such a cool story. Like yeah. that's every like that story should be told to every kid that is in some Midwestern or Southern town that's
yeah.
like, I have a dream, and someone goes, no, you go to work at the hardware store like your dad
yeah.
did. And then that it's just, it's a beautiful story. And then you left there and did you start the Royal Hounds right after that, or was there a...
No, the Royal Hounds actually started in my hometown in 2011.
Okay.
Like, this was probably about maybe 2.5-3 years before I left teaching. So, you know, in those early days of the Royal Hounds, I was doing crazy things like... I would play in Lexington, Kentucky, and I would finish the show at 2 in the morning. I'd get in my car and drive, 3.5 hours back to the school that I would teach at. I would sleep an hour in the band room. I'd get up and teach all day and get in my car and then drive to the next city on the tour, play the gig, drive back, sleep in the band room secretly without anyone knowing, teach all day. And I actually experienced like legit exhaustion after doing that for a while, but it was just like burning the candle at both ends to make it work, you know?
Yep. I get that. Again, I completely parallel worlds. Cause with stand up, you're doing the same thing. There's been several times where I've driven up to Chicago, which is about with no traffic, three and a half hours.
Yeah.
Do a show on a Tuesday night, do the Tuesday 10 at Zany's up in Rosemont, which is further north than Chicago, and either crash at a friend's house for a few hours, get up, drive, and be back to work, or get in the car, drive back, and get up and just be in my cubicle just praying that nobody comes back, or, you know, just nobody comes to check on me. Please don't let anyone come check on me. Or put a note up on my whiteboard. Yeah, the sunglasses are on because I have a migraine. And people would be like, okay, well, we'll just leave him alone.
Yeah.
It's so you guys also have, to go back to the Royal Hounds, you've got, what, 3 studio albums? Is that right?
Yeah, 3 studio albums. You know what? I'll tell you, because we haven't said this to anyone, but we're secretly recording a new album. Like, we want to be productive during this COVID-19 quarantine thing. So we're secretly recording an album of 19 covers, and we're calling it Covered 19.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I love that.
So hopefully when all this is done, we'll have, you know, and we are an originals type of band, you know, we can't really get together that often to work up originals. And so we're like, this is a great opportunity to just record these songs that everyone requests at our shows anyways, you know, for these covers. So we're like, yeah, just a cool thing.
That's really, so you just bumped up your episode to like the second episode. I mean, like I've got, and the only reason you wouldn't be the debut episode is because on the first episode I recorded, I was like, this is the first episode we're recording. So I got it. I kind of have to do that one first, but now, cause I want to be the exclusive. I want that.
Yeah. That's, well, you just got it, man. There you go.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. So you've also, okay. I want to go back and talk about the albums. Yeah. Cause you can legit see I'm losing the word, but you can definitely see the changes between each album with the evolution, that's the word I was looking for. You can definitely see an evolution between each album. But do you have like, and I know you may get asked this a lot, but do you have like an album that particularly is your favorite of the 3 studios?
You know, all right, I'll start with this. I have an album that's my least favorite. Our first album was, my songwriting was so amateur, and it was just straight up just like so much just rockabilly and no creativity in chord progressions and really inside the box. And the quality of recording wasn't great. My songwriting wasn't great, you know. But then I feel like with the second album, I really started like branching out and not listening to rockabilly for inspiration, listening to Buena Vista Social Club, you know, listening to Russian circus music, you know, to really kind of expand the songwriting. And then the third album, you know, so that second album, I really feel like I started to come into my own more as a songwriter. And then that third album, when we added our Brazilian guitarist, Mateus Canteri, to that album, I just kind of hit its peak because, I mean, there's a reason that we spent 2 years working on getting him his work visa so that he could move to Nashville from Brazil. And because he is hands down the best I've ever seen, you know, when you have Brent Mason, who is the most recorded guitarist in history, I mean, pretty much any country song from the 80s or 90s he was playing guitar on. When we were recording this last album, he was recording next door, walked over into our studio to go say hi to Mateus and had known about his guitar playing for years down in Brazil.
Wow.
I was like, man, I mean, and Mateus is so humble. He is the nicest guy.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So honestly, I would listen to you describe the first album and then moving on. And this is exactly how I describe raising my three children.
Yeah.
It's very amateur on the first one. A lot of rookie mistakes, a lot of,
can't stand your firstborn, but
he's fine. I love him for what he is. That's the thing. If he listens, he probably won't listen to this, but if he does, he'll laugh because I had him very young. And so he and I have helped raise each other. And so now I've got this adult person that I'm like, there's no way I'm old enough to have this adult person running around who loves to lean over and tell me to blow it out my ass. I love the kid to death. So your three albums are, so the first one was I'm in Love with a Zombie.
Yeah.
And you have Poker All Night, which is the album that I was most familiar with because that's what was out when you and I met, or what was coming out, I think, or was it all, no, because you had the music video coming up.
It had already come out I think maybe 5-6 months prior or something.
You talked about the music video, which was a lot of fun. I love that music video.
I'm trying to remember which one it was. Was it the one with Meemaw Wants to Dance?
No, this was
On the Verge with that awful wig I was wearing.
I think it may have been.
Yeah.
But and then the newest album, I bring this up because I love the title. It may be my favorite title of any album ever.
Oh.
But Low Class Songs for High Class People.
Oh, but
I love that.
I just always love the juxtaposition, where the Royal Hounds, but that, we cut called the Royal Hounds because I wanted something that was going to separate us from the pack. And so much of, at the time, rockabilly culture was, hot rods and greasers and PBR. And I was like, well, what's the opposite of that? Royalty. But, we still do these kind of low class, stupid songs, So I was like, oh, I like that juxtaposition of low class and high class,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I again, coming from a kid that was raised in the sticks, who listened to nothing but Merle Haggard and to hear, that it is that juxtaposition, but also, sorry to go back, listening to nothing but Merle Haggard and Hank Jr. and Hank Sr., depending on which grandparent I was hanging out with.
Yeah.
But also was trained in Shakespearean theater.
Mm-hmm.
It just speaks to my soul. Because everyone, what I love is the idea that everyone thinks that Shakespeare is this highbrow theater. It wasn't. He was the dick and fart joke of his time,
which is
beautiful. And took me until probably, I can't remember how old I was, and I finally was probably my fifth or sixth Shakespeare production that I was doing, and I was like, oh, he was just the Judd Apatow of his time. He was super popular. And could balance all these dirty jokes with all of these heavy ideas. And it was, man, I think I just wrote a thesis. I really should have.
There you go. Yeah. There you go.
I got some typing. We got to end this because I got to do all this while the.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks for being on. Anyway. No. So, as we know, Unconvince Me. I told you I was bad at transitions. But on Convince Me, we talk about stuff we don't like that maybe we have felt a little ashamed about not liking, and stuff that we love that maybe we were made to feel ashamed that we love. We're going to concentrate a little bit more going forward. We're going to have a little combination of stuff on the show.
Yeah.
But because I'm a comic, then that's what I love, that's what I know, and that's what every conversation turns to anyway. That's what we're going to talk about. Now, I know I threw you a little bit of a curveball, Scott, when I was like, hey, in the middle of you concentrating on, here's the original concept for the show, but now let's concentrate on this.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about the stuff, the thing that you hate, that you feel everyone else loves, but also let's talk about what doesn't make you laugh, because we'll get that out of the way so we can talk about the love, because that's what we're all about.
Totally, totally. Well, you know, I'll first preface this by saying that I really hope that my wife doesn't hear this portion of the show. Because early on in us dating, I mentioned how I didn't like Big Bang Theory at all, and I thought it was stupid, and she likes it. Yeah. Now that I've gotten to know her and appreciate her and respect her and love her, I realize why she likes it. You know, she's oftentimes just gets very stressed, and Big Bang Theory is just something very easy to watch. You know what you're going to get, you know, and she enjoys it.
Yeah.
And I can't fault someone for just enjoying something. If that's what brings you happiness, you know, even like bro country, I can't stand bro country, but if someone gets joy from bro country, all right, great. You enjoy what you enjoy.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, and that's, and see, this is what we're about on this show. We, just because we don't like it doesn't mean we don't understand why someone else does. And we don't look down on that person.
You know,
I know I mentioned to you, there was a friend of mine, Clay Foley, on a different episode who was defending Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
And I don't, I'm with you. Not a big fan.
Yeah.
I know for him, he's saying that he likes it because of the, essentially the joke structure.
Mm-hmm.
He knows, here's a setup. Here's where it's going. Here's the punchline. He appreciates it for the essentially the scientific side of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
The formula is there.
Yeah.
But I'm with my wife, Nicole, whom you've met, was the same way. She liked Big Bang Theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I would try to watch it and be like, all of these people are awful. I can't do this.
Yeah,
is that kind of the same feeling that you got when you were watching it?
Well, so I've seen some episodes with my wife, and not a whole ton of the series, because she'll now, whenever I come around, she'll shut it off, because even though I try to convince her, I'm not judging you, she doesn't feel comfortable with me around, because she knows my sort of theories on writing and what makes like for good writing and not good writing, and she just doesn't want to feel like I'm putting pressure, even though I'm trying to do everything I can to not push pressure, despite going on NPR and talking about why I don't like that show. I think a few things about the show that I don't like. It is the formulaic. That is one thing. The setup punchline. It just doesn't appeal to me. You know, I really like it's very formulaic. Whereas you have a show like let's say Schitt's Creek, and that show is I find that show hilarious, but it's very much character driven, and so I was watching this episode where Alexis tells her dad that she's going to go to college, and so the dad Eugene Levy The jokes aren't set up punchline, clever humor, but the funny came from his reaction in him trying to control himself from, or to keep himself from influencing what her major should be.
Right.
And just watching him try to wrestle with this, he really wants to tell her, but it's my daughter and it's her own life, you know, and the humor came from that, and there was no setup punchline sort of stuff. I also don't like the way that where the humor kind of stems from. So I feel like a lot of people point to Big Bang Theory as being nerd humor. But to me, I always thought of it as it's Wikipedia nerd humor. It's kind of like, we haven't had a joke about comic books in a while. Let's go to Wikipedia and look up Green Lantern. Oh, here's a fact about Green Lantern. Let's fit it in there. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas, you know, a lot of these shows like Community or Arrested Development and stuff, their pop culture references are a little more organic. They come out naturally, you know. I guess the final thing, because I don't want to dwell on negative, you know,
right,
stuff.
Right.
But the final. Oh yeah, going back to that last point, I feel like Big Bang Theory is, or rather, like Community is written by a room full of true nerds. You know, people who really, really get nerd culture. Big Bang Theory, I feel like, is written by a group of people who aren't nerds. And so they write from a perspective of how do, quote unquote, how do regular people perceive nerds?
Yes.
And that's the final issue that I have with it, is that the joke, the humor from Big Bang Theory on the surface seems like, oh, the comedy's coming because they really understand nerd culture. But no, the comedy supposedly from Big Bang Theory comes from, we're making fun of these people for being nerdy.
Yes.
You know, Sheldon he'll make some statement about, oh, you can't slip on that floor because your shoe has friction, you know, and if you worded it that way and said you can't slip on it because of friction, it wouldn't be funny. But instead they make him have this really drawn out scientific explanation about what friction is, and everyone laughs at him. Mm-hmm. And or if someone makes a reference to Star Trek, it's they laugh at them because they like Star Trek. But almost we as a society have gotten to a point now where we're celebrating nerds. You know, we celebrate that deep, vast knowledge. And I feel like Big Bang Theory is behind the times because they are existing in the 1980s when we used to make fun of nerds.
Yes.
Yeah.
All of the jokes feel like they're coming from a place of just a mean place.
Yeah.
A place of it's like it's written by bullies.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it's all – they're like, okay, we're going to get this room full of bullies to write a show about nerds. But we got to have the hot chick. And they're like, well, the hot chick, even though she's going to bang one of the nerds, is still going to be real mean to him.
Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
He's just going to take it because he's a nerd.
Yeah, yeah.
And
go ahead.
No, I was saying that when you said that, that's kind of what just popped in my head. I was like, it's just – it's a room full of bullies, where it was like you said, a Community was one of them. All the – even I can't think. Jeff, the main character,
mm-hmm.
he's there's a progression. There's a character progression for him. You know, the two nerdy characters on Community were written not as – punchline, they weren't formulas for punchlines. They were fully realized human beings that just, you know, happened to be the way they were. And everyone just kind of was okay. Because the whole episode with them playing Dungeons and Dragons, and they were like, oh, this is stupid. And then they all got into it.
Yeah.
You know, that's, instead of laughing at, you were laughing with, but on Big Bang Theory, when they talk about Dungeons and Dragons, the whole intent is to laugh at.
Yeah, you're right. And I feel like as someone who grew up, well, I've been a nerd all my life. You know, I grew up loving Star Trek: The Next Generation. And I feel like a lot of shows, comedies that have nerdy jokes that were written by people who have suffered at the hands of bullies all their lives for being nerds. Big Bang Theory, I don't believe they've earned the street cred as nerds to really, you know, and that's why all their jokes are just so surface. And yeah, it's, you know, laughing at nerds. But, yeah. You know, I guess the final point about Big Bang Theory is I also feel like they are insulting to their audience, too. Not just nerds, but their viewers. They will explain a joke and not trust that the audience has a deep enough reference well to get it. So I remember there was this one joke where they were talking about Megan Fox. And the person actually said, oh, if I could go on a date, I would go on a date with Megan Fox from Transformers. And all the guys in the room were like, oh, yeah. But see, that's the thing. If you had nerds sitting around having a conversation and they all knew Transformers, they would know who Megan Fox were. So the writers were pandering to the audience, and they do it so much, they just assume, oh, the audience is too dumb to get our jokes. Yeah. So we're going to explain it to them. Whereas Community, they would make a reference, and if the audience doesn't get it, too bad, they're moving on. And they have a lot of those one percenter jokes where like 1% of the audience will get it, but it's hilarious. Yeah. But they assume that the audience is smart enough to get the humor and then just plow right on through.
Well, it's Community did a good job with what a lot of stand-ups, especially like to throw one out, Patton Oswalt, where it was you're going to do your material, and who likes it is going to like it. They're going to tell their friends.
Yeah.
And if you don't get it, good. Go away. We don't want you.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't care if our audience is, you know, four people. If those four people are really getting it that night, great. Because those four people will go tell four friends, and then they'll tell four friends, and it will build from there. They were fine with having that slow build. Whereas Big Bang Theory was designed, and although the writers made a good living, and it was on for a long time, and all the actors have made a lot of money, I'm not by any means insulting them. But that show was designed to sell toothpaste. You know, it was designed to sell products. But then you get, like even Parks and Rec. There's a lot of punchlines in there and a lot of reactions.
Yeah.
But because of delivery and because of character, like just the way that the actors built the characters, you cared about them.
Yeah, and I think that's how the writers wrote those characters is, you know, I mean, so much of Parks and Rec and a lot of those types of shows are character-driven. It's just like, okay, how would this character react? What's the funny in the way they'd react? Whereas Big Bang Theory seems like, okay, we want I don't know which character, and I know it wasn't Sheldon, but let's just say Sheldon. Sheldon is going to go into space. How do we get him there? You know, and then they would – you know, the characters might not have like a realistic reaction to something, but it's all to serve the purpose of getting them to the end point. And that just doesn't work for me.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other shows feel more, more natural and more, again, I'm using a buzzword, but organic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then here's a tried and true formula that we know if we do X plus Y, we get Z.
Yeah.
And if, again, it worked. And it had a huge following and a great audience. And I can't fault them for that. And also, I understand why people like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just not the audience.
Yeah. And that's fine. And I really, truly believe that that is a good place to be, because I don't want to, you know, look down on the people who enjoy it just because they enjoy it, because everybody enjoys just different things, you know, and you know, I love my wife, and she is the smartest person I know, hands down. She loves that show. And I know that it's not because she's dumb. She's incredibly smart, you know, and so, yeah, that's just not for me.
Sometimes we all just like junk food for our brain.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I will occasionally watch a reality crime show just to have a little candy for my brain. Watch a little Cops just to have a little gummy bears from a brain, just to clear it out and be like, look at these dumb people. He's gonna get tased. He's getting tased. There's nothing there. Okay, yeah, but here's the more important part, and here's what also fascinates me. You know, knowing what doesn't make people laugh is great, but what makes you laugh? What is it that you love?
Well, that's a different sort of question. I need to give some thought to what actually makes me laugh in a big picture sort of way. I came to the table with like, oh, here's something that makes me laugh that I feel is underappreciated.
Oh, no, hit me with that. Okay. Hit me with that. Yeah.
So, back in, around like 1999 to 2000 or 2001, Comedy Central had a show called Strangers with Candy. Do you like Strangers with Candy?
Absolutely. Amy Sedaris is a genius.
Oh, she is a genius. I think she is like, I hesitate to say this because this other person's so polarizing. I always thought she was funny. I feel like Amy Sedaris is the American Tracy Ullman.
Yes.
Yeah. And she has so many characters and she is so funny, but she's a bit under the radar, mm-hmm. you know, to where when people list their favorite comedians, very few people might throw out Amy Sedaris first, you know?
Right. She's got the At Home with Amy Sedaris right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is,
and she's like also like a female Phil Hartman. Phil Hartman, sadly, you know, I was at the NBC studios and went in and to the SNL studio, and they asked, who's your favorite SNL personality? And I said, Phil Hartman. And like the guy giving the tour was stunned. He was like, no one has ever said Phil Hartman. Oh my gosh. They always say Will Ferrell and Adam Sandler, John Belushi, but no one ever says Phil Hartman. And I think that that's because Phil Hartman and Amy Sedaris are so good at disappearing into their characters, you don't notice the human there.
Yeah.
When Jimmy Fallon would do a character, he would laugh, you'd see it. Whenever Adam Sandler would do a character, he'd almost always do the same character, and you would see Adam Sandler there. But Phil Hartman could disappear so well, and Amy Sedaris can disappear so well into her characters, mm-hmm. you forget there is an actress there.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Oh, absolutely. And which is a real shame, because she is... Well, Strangers with Candy, it helped to boost Stephen Colbert.
Oh yeah,
not to take away from Amy, but just to, if people aren't familiar, you had Stephen Colbert on that show as one of the teachers, and he was UCB, wasn't he? Upright Citizens Brigade guy.
Yeah, I know he was Second City also, I think.
Okay, maybe that's –
sometimes runs together, yeah. You know, but they all did meet in their improv troupe.
Yes,
you know,
yeah. And then – but yeah, the concept of a 40-some-year-old woman who has to go back to high school and then has all the same high school problems as she would have.
Yeah.
But it's such a, and it's so ridiculous. It's so ridiculously funny.
And I think on its first airing, I remember watching it, and I only got back into it maybe in the past 2 years. And so on its first airing, I didn't get it. I was too young to understand that this is all a takeoff of After School Specials. And I don't even think I realized how raunchy the humor was. For that show, which is very cool, because I think that prior to that show, I can't remember many female comedians who were as raunchy as Amy Sedaris was on that show. I'm sure there were plenty of male comedians who were, but Amy Sedaris was kind of groundbreaking in doing that and laid the foundation for a lot of these female comics that just go balls to the wall, filthy, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
but she did it. They did it in a smart way. It wasn't just being blue to be blue, you know. Mm-hmm. It was used for really good comedic effect. Well, you know,
and because you know, in at the time you were watching it, the fact that a lot of it went over your head
mm-hmm.
means that the writing was really good because you can do blunt, punchy in the face. Here's a dick and fart joke.
Yeah.
Which don't get me wrong. I love a good dick and fart joke. I'm an American. I would be very unpatriotic if I didn't. But with jokes like that, where at certain ages it goes over your head.
Yeah. And I was extremely naive at the time. And granted, when this was on, I was like a senior in high school or something like that. So I was old enough to where I should have known, but I was extremely naive back then.
Unfamiliar with the ways of the world.
But yeah, that the show is like nobody knows about this show for some reason. You know, I try to tell people about it, and I describe it as it's the Cards Against Humanity of TV shows. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And it's just, it's so creative on so many levels, you know, and so much of the way the show was written was improv. They would basically tell, you know, they would tell each other, okay, in this scene, this is going to happen. And then they would improv around, and they would have somebody sitting off with a notepad writing down all the best lines. And then they would go and film that. And that's how they would write their scripts. And then when they would film the scene, they would just leave the cameras rolling. And then they would just have to keep making up lines, you know, even after the scripted part was done, you know. I just love that style of writing, you know, if you can pull it off.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and here's the idea. I think Christopher Guest does that with every one of his movies.
Yeah.
It's the, here's where we need to get, and here's the points we need to hit.
Yeah.
However we get there, just make it happen. And it's, and it wasn't. You can tell in situations when it's good, like Strangers with Candy or a Christopher Guest movie, you can tell when someone's trying to go for the laugh and when they're just playing the character. And when they're just being the character, it's 1,000 times funnier.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I was not expecting a Strangers with Candy. That's not... Yeah.
It's my new favorite show. You know, I just for the past 2 years, I've watched like several episodes every single week. You know, I swear I am on a mission to tell this world that this is one of the funniest shows in the history of television. You know,
well, and I think with the direction that that television and comedy has gone in just in the past 5 years. Strangers with Candy it fits more now than with the landscape it was in 20 years ago.
And yet on the, it also, I, you know, yes, I agree with that. And I also don't see how it would ever be allowed to be on TV. Like now, I mean, some of the things that they would say, I don't know that I would even feel comfortable repeating on this radio show, you know? I mean, I can say this one thing. The principal was named Onyx Blackmoon. They just leaned into that. You couldn't do that on TV today, but that character is my favorite character on the whole show. The actor's name is Greg Hollingsman or something like that. And he plays the part so weird. Mm-hmm. He is so weird. But the fact that, I mean, you could never have a character named that on TV.
No.
You know? And I'm not the sort of person who's like, the world's too politically correct, blah, blah, blah. No, I very much think, you know, there are lines to be towed, you know, but that show, I was reading the other day, their censor that they worked with was a huge fan of the show and let them get away with pretty much anything.
That's,
you know, yeah. Hilarious. So, yeah. So it's a great show.
With comedy, you're talking about getting away with stuff, you know, 20 years ago. Well, even, God, when did it come out? It was longer ago than that. But anyway, Dodgeball.
Mm-hmm.
The movie Dodgeball. There are it's a lot of slurs in that movie.
Yeah, a lot of slurs,
and I had forgotten about that.
Yeah.
And we were just like, I mean, don't get me wrong, Dodgeball is still funny. And the joke isn't, the punchline isn't the slur. The punchline is the fact that this old guy is still stuck in that
time frame.
And that, and he's still using these old terms to be insulting. That's the joke, and it's easily missed. It's like when people tried to go after Robert Downey Jr. recently for doing blackface. And the joke was, no, he was in blackface, but the idea was to make fun of actors that think that they can do that. And there were, I know that got swept away, but you know, it just, it's stuff that at the time you're like, oh, this is fine. But now we're like, we evolve as a society and as a community of humans and as comedians, and any comedian's like, I can't believe I can't say this. You can say whatever you want. Just make it funny.
I personally think no topic in comedy is off limits. It's how you present it. You know, you don't mock the victim. Mm-hmm. You know, I hesitate to bring this up on a, but George Carlin had a bit on one of his albums, and the bit on the CD, you could read it, was called Rape Can Be Funny. Now, rape is not funny itself, but Carlin talked about, and it's been so long since I've heard this bit, but Carlin was able to pull it off to where you weren't laughing at that horrible act. You know, he was making fun of, you know, the things around it, like, you know, we're going into dark territory here. I want to still kind of keep it light. But, you know, he was basically doing it to prove that no topic is off topic. It's in how you approach it.
Right. It's the concept of you punch up, you punch out, you punch in, but you never punch down.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You know, I do some jokes where I'm always ultimately the butt of the joke.
Yeah.
I have a joke that, if taken completely out of context, could make me sound really bad. I'll just put it that way. But I have done it enough that ultimately, no matter who listens to it, they go, oh, he's the butt of the joke. It's not it's not over here. And I'm not a controversial comic.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I like to toe the line.
Yeah.
For fun. Kyle Kinane on Netflix, the comedians, and he had the 30-minute special on Netflix, did a most of his set about the Ku Klux Klan.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hilarious. And
yeah.
It wasn't, you know, oh, these guys are okay. He's just making fun of them constantly. But
yeah.
If you were only half paying attention or had only half a brain, it could almost seem like he was sympathizing.
Yeah.
And trying to make them a sympathetic character when really he's just, he was making fun of them and himself the entire time.
Yeah.
And like you said, there's no subject that is off limits.
I used to do this character just kind of for fun and stuff, but I actually entered a Knoxville's kind of version of American Idol, you know, where it was just at a local bar or something, singing contest. I knew all the judges. And so I didn't actually want to enter as me. I really could care less about, you know, winning a contest like that. But I entered as this character named Skeeter. And I wore these, like, really way too short jeans cutoffs and a midriff cutoff and a mullet wig and like a handlebar mustache sort of thing, you know, played it really, really redneck and misogynistic, you know. And but the thing was, in the misogynistic character that I was doing, I was never actually like making fun of women, I was making fun of misogynists. Uh-huh. You know, I was being a buffoon on stage, and in a way it was like, yeah, misogyny is pretty a very crappy thing, you know. It's mm-hmm. it's horrible, but if you can play it right to where you're making for the misogynists, yes, then you could do comedy about that.
Even, right.
You know.
Right. Again, as long as it's punch up, punch out, punch yeah. in,
punch in. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And that's more often than not, that's where I land. Is just because if you punch up, you're gonna. Probably piss off somebody.
Yeah.
That, well, I like that guy. Well, I like this guy. Just don't bother. You know, you punch out. That's still, you know, you're still tricky to just as long as I'm punching myself in the face.
Yeah. Yeah.
The audience loves me, and it doesn't matter. I have done. I've got a. Not to. I'm not running a bit, but I've got a joke about guns.
Mm-hmm.
And I have it is probably an 8-minute bit. It involves a couple different ideas about firearms, and I have done it for very liberal crowds, and I've done it for very conservative crowds.
Mm-hmm.
Both crowds. In fact, I did it one night at a comedy club in Arkansas, where you could see the split down the middle of the room. One side was leaned more red. One side leaned more blue.
And yeah, yeah.
I did that joke, and everyone laughed. And I was just, and I looked up, and the owner of the club is in the back of the room, and he kind of gave me the high sign, like there it was. That's my boy. And I was like, ha ha, yes. And that was it. Was towards the beginning of working that joke.
Yeah.
But I was like, I kept thinking to myself the whole drive down there. I'm like, I don't know if I should do that joke there. It's Arkansas. I don't know. I don't know if I should do that joke. And it was my wife. It was like, just do your material.
Yeah.
Just do your material and have fun with it, and people will be on board. And so she did get to give me a good, see, told you. Always listen to me, because she's very smart, and I should always listen to her.
Yeah. Right. Don't we love our wives?
I do. I've got the best wife. I know we all say that, but it's true, because I get made fun of because people are like, well, she's not even there. Why are you complimenting her? Because I am, because she's the best
thing.
She's
going to listen to this on playback, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I sleep heavy and she could stab me.
Yeah.
She's good at that. All right. So, Scott, I appreciate you being on the show. Is there anything else you'd want to touch on before we go?
No, I just appreciate getting to talk about this. You know, like my background, even before I became a working musician, was I got my start in comedy improv, and all through my early 20s, like, I was unsuccessful, but I tried getting a comedy writing class started at the University of Tennessee because I was an English major. And I was just like, my dream was to write for The Onion, and which obviously what they have like 10 staff writers and that's it or yeah, something.
Good thing
you know?
That didn't pan out, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, right. But yeah, I was like, comedy, even though I'm not a stand-up comic myself, I have just a huge background in comedy. Like I would take a stab and say I might own one of the largest collections of silent film comedies in the state of Tennessee. You know, I mean, I was obsessed with Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin for so long, you know, so I always do interviews about music. I never get to do a comedy interview, and I love that topic.
Well, if you want to come back on, I'll have you back on sometime.
All right.
We'll talk about something else. Okay, tell people where they can find you and how to keep track of you.
Yeah, so we're at theroyalhounds.com. We have Instagram. We have Facebook. We now have TikTok as of last week, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around that one. And if you're ever in Nashville when quarantine is not a thing anymore, we play down at Robert's Western World, which is like the last place in Nashville where you're going to find like traditional country music, Hank Williams sort of stuff, you know. We play a little more raucous than Hank Williams stuff, but we do a couple Hank songs.
You play the way Hank partied.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah, use that. I get credit, but use that as your tag.
Okay, that works.
Yeah, it's like I came up
with a McDonald's song.
Yeah, what's that?
The McDonald's.
That will be an epic. And it needs to be an epic song. I really want to turn that into a short story.
In my mind, yeah.
I am very excited. I'm very excited. All right. Well, Scott, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you.
And for Convince Me, I'm Larry Smith, and thanks for joining us.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter.